We have in store for you an opportunity to hear William Federer. And I want to just give you a little quick report because several have asked me how the trip to South Africa went. I'm going to give you more information about that next week when we want to save time for our speaker this morning. But I will tell you this in summary, that I was sure impressed with the fervency of the church in South Africa, at least among the people that I was with. They sang with gusto, they loved the Word of God, and they were energetic about learning and studying and understanding what they should have. They had a deep gratitude for the missionaries that had come, had worked with them, had planted the gospel, and they are carrying that torch high and on fire. It was very encouraging to see that. Well, we are blessed this weekend to have William Federer, who is an author. He's run for office, and he is a walking encyclopedia on the history, not just of our own country, but the history of the world. And it's been a fascinating experience for those that have taken advantage of the fact that we've had him here since Thursday night for you to learn and to grow. And so this morning, he's going to bring some unique history relative to our own country and what gives rise to Thanksgiving, if that's correct. And so with no further ado, let me bring William Federer. And thank you, Bill, for being a part of Mountain View.
Thank you, Pastor. Well, it is a tremendous honor for me to be here, and I want to let you know how impressed I am with your pastor, Bill Knepper, and his wife, Sue, and I just want to thank God for them and the tremendous ministry that the Lord is using through them right here. And I mentioned before, but my wife's name is Sue, so whenever I hear Bill and Sue, I always like, look, you know. And I want to thank Cy and Dottie for having me there at the Candlelight Mansion, and also special to Bob and Martha Holland, and they're just tremendously generous hosts and inviting me up and just taking care of me. Thank you so much. You guys are absolutely tremendous. Did want to mention a few books that I have left. One is called Prayers and Presidents. It's all the past presidents, their proclamations of prayer. And it was Abraham Lincoln who made the Day of Thanksgiving an annual event. So every president from Lincoln until now has had a Day of Thanksgiving to Almighty God. And I list all the ones in there with Teddy Roosevelt and Grover Cleveland. And it was Harry S. Truman that made the National Day of Prayer an annual event. But that's that book, Prayers and Presidents. Another book called Change to Change, and it's a survey of world history and how unique America is in all of the 6,000 years of recorded human history. And then a book on Islam, it's what every American needs to know about the Quran. I'm going to talk just a couple of the stories out of that. And then a DVD. I do a daily TV show called Faith in History, and it's on many stations across the country as well as DirecTV. And this is a 5 half-hour TV show. It's called Islamic Conquest, Past and Present. But we're going to have lunch and have turkey, and we're going to remember the pilgrims. And I thought that we can appreciate the turkey and the Thanksgiving a little bit more if we can go back in time and sort of put ourselves in what they experienced. Well, we have the situation. Europe was all Catholic, and then Martin Luther starts the Reformation in 1517. And he had a spiritual experience. The just shall live by faith, and so forth. Well, there was England, and Henry VIII decided to split from the Catholic Church, not because he had a spiritual experience, but because he wanted another wife. He was married to Catherine of Aragon. She was the daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella, the ones who sent Columbus to America, right? So we got Columbus coming to America, sent by Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain. They had a daughter named Catherine who was married to Henry VIII. After 18 years, she does not have a son. She has a daughter, Mary, but not a son. So Henry VIII decides to divorce her. And Henry VIII went on to have 6 wives. And their fates were divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived. So Henry VIII was not a really nice guy to be married to. He was, when he was young, he was really fit and athletic. And back then, the guys would show their calves. You know, like today, guys like to show off their biceps and wear the, you know, the wife beater type shirts, whatever they're called. My son's 22 and he weightlifts. You know. But back then, the men would show off their calves. And so Henry VIII, he'd wear these stockings and he'd wear these really tight garters. And anyway, He would do fencing with some of the other guys, sort of like our current president was playing basketball, and then he got hit in the eye. Remember that? He had to get some stitches. Well, Henry VIII is in a jousting match, and he's, you know, young, the young, fit king of England, and so everybody's cheering, and he comes out, and he thinks that they're cheering for him. They're yelling, "Close your visor." He had his visor up, and he's charging with the other guy, and the other guy's lance hits him, goes through where the open visor is, hits him in the head, knocks him off the horse. He has a concussion. After that, he's just a little bit more paranoid. It doesn't have a really healthy diet. Like, all he eats is meat. He thinks vegetables is sissy food. Right? And so, they get him turkey and beef and ham and, you know, meat pot pies and everything, and he gets up to around 400 pounds. Anyway, he does because of these tight stockings, he doesn't get good circulation in his leg, and so he ends up getting open sores, and he gets gangrene. And none of the doctors want to go in and tell him that he needs to get his leg amputated. I'm not going to tell him the trouble. I was like, no, you tell him. I'm not going to tell him the trouble, you know. And so they just let him die. Anyway, so that's how he died. But anyway, later in life is when he decided to get rid of Catherine of Aragon as his first wife, and he was Catholic, and the Pope said, no, I'm not going to recognize the divorce. And Henry says, guess what? I'm far enough away from Italy, and you're busy with all kinds of other stuff. I'm just going to declare myself my own Pope. So he starts the Church of England, puts himself on as the head, and goes on to have six wives. And again, their fates were divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived. Well, his advisors suggested that if he really wanted to solidify his break with Rome, he should stop using that Latin Bible and get himself an English Bible. A couple years earlier, he had William Tyndale killed, who had translated the Bible into English. But his men go out, and they sort of find out what's left of William Tyndale's Bible, and they do a little bit more. They call it the Matthew Coverdale Bible, and they have a nice picture of King Henry VIII in the front page of it, passing the Bibles down to the lords and the church leaders, and they're all saying, oh, thank you, you know, and it's all in this, you know, nice engraved picture. And he goes, oh, I like that. So they spread it all around England, like 11,000 copies of it, and something unexpected happened. People began to read it and began to compare what's in this Bible to this king divorcing and beheading his wives and being over the Church of England. So lo and behold, this group decided they wanted to purify the Church of England, so they were nicknamed the Puritans. Well, the king didn't think he needed any purifying, thank you. So he persecuted this group. A couple kings later was Charles I. And Charles I would send spies into the churches to make sure the pastor was following the official Anglican liturgy, sort of like IRS agents to listen to the sermons. And king, Charles I, had an archbishop in the Anglican church named William Laud. And Laud composed a list of all the leaders in England and put an O or a P by their name, O for Orthodox and P for Puritan. And the Puritans lost their jobs. They were purged from academia. There was even a professor at Oxford named Alexander Layton, and he didn't like what the king was doing with the church, and so the king ordered him to have his nose cut in half, his ears cut off, branded on the face as a heretic, whipped twice, and put in the Tower of London until he died. So it was sort of serious to not believe the way the king wanted you to believe. Sir Thomas More, who was a really strong supporter of the king who, when he was Catholic, when the king switches, he didn't, and he gets killed. And William Penn gets expelled from Oxford for having a Bible study in his dorm room rather than attending the Anglican chapel service. And so, anyway, so this is Henry VIII. Now, there's another group in England who decides it's beyond hope of trying to purify the Church of England, so they separate themselves, and they're called Separatists. And we have another name for them. Now, Henry VIII dies, remember, 400 pounds guy. His daughter Mary takes over, and she decides to bring the country of England back under the Catholic Church. She had been married to the King of Spain. Well, she ends up killing about 300 people, so she's nicknamed Bloody Mary. Well, she dies, and her half-sister Elizabeth takes over England. And the King of Spain claims that England belongs to him because he had been married to Mary and he was Catholic. And so the Spain was riding high. They were the most powerful empire in the world. They had discovered the New World with Columbus and claimed it all and got all the gold. And they had, their family was tied together with the Austro-Hungarian emperors and rulers. And so they basically, Charles V at one point was the richest, you know, ruled it all. They had just defeated the Muslims at the Battle of Lepanto, which was the largest battle on the Mediterranean Sea, the last battle done just with rowing vessels. And then, instead of following up and freeing the Greek islands, they took their ships, what's called the Spanish Armada, and they decided to squelch the Protestant Reformation in England. And as their ships get close, they send, these things are like 3 and 4 stories tall, packed with thousands of sailors. Look at them. Imagine if you were in England and you saw that coming up. I mean, that was like, but see the clouds in the background? Well, what was that? That was a hurricane that was blowing up. So here's Spain, and that's where they take off, and they're right around there. And there is a, the English don't have a navy. They have these little small boats captained by Sir Francis Drake, but they're small. They can sort of dart around where these great big Spanish ships, they can't, you know, maneuver as well. Well, it's one night, it's windy, the Spanish Armada is anchored and waiting, and Sir Francis Drake goes upwind of where they're at, takes a ship, lights it on fire, and lets it float with the wind and the current toward where all the Spanish ships are anchored, and the thing is just billowing flames, and the Spanish ships, our sails are going to get caught. They don't have time to crank up these anchors. It takes a long time, so they have to cut the anchors, and then these boats are left to blow in this hurricane that picks up, and they don't have cell phones, so they don't know where all the other ones are going, so they're all just sort of dispersed in the middle of the night. And the winds blow them on this side of England, and then when they come down this side, they all get smashed. And what's left is crippled and goes back to Spain. This is called the sinking of the Spanish Armada. In Holland, the Holland and the Dutch were working together. And so they had a day of celebration, a day of Thanksgiving. They actually printed a coin where it said, man proposes, God disposes. and the other side has men kneeling in prayer. Now, Spain eventually invaded Holland. And you know how the Dutch in Holland defeated the Spanish army? Any ideas? Holland is below sea level, right? They got windmills to pump the water over the dikes. So they break the dikes. And they let the ocean water come in and flood the Spanish armies, and so that's how the Spanish were defeated. But at this point, Spain lost their monopoly. They were the most powerful. They had wiped out a French Protestant settlement in Florida called Fort Caroline. In 1565, a bunch of French Protestants, Huguenots, settled in around Jacksonville, Florida. The Spanish found out about it and basically butchered all the men and sold the women, or took the women and children captive. So the other countries decided that Spain's not as tough as they thought, and so they would begin to settle the New World. Here's a picture of the Spanish Armada being sunk. And so here is Elizabeth, the Queen of England, and here is Sir Walter Raleigh, and he settles an area in the New World that he names after the Virgin Queen Elizabeth, so it's nicknamed, so it's called Virginia. Right? And so anyway, Sir Walter Raleigh, He has to take time off because he founds the colony in 1784, but then 1788 is when the Spanish Armada attacks, and so 1789 he goes back over to the colony and finds out that it's gone. So it's called the Roanoke Colony, or the lost colony that happened in America. And so from around 1788, nothing's really happening, and finally in around 1606 is they decide to try again to settle the colony, and that's when Captain John Smith goes over. Now, Captain John Smith was a pretty interesting guy. When he was 20 years old, he left England and went to Hungary and fought the Muslims who were invading. And the Muslims had the long war, and they were unbeatable. I mean, they were just brutal, and they were capturing and killing. And one of the stories is that they needed to get supplies to a fortress that the Muslims had surrounded, and so he took a gunpowder and would stick it in twine, and they would twist it and put some more gunpowder in twine, twist it, and he would put these strings of it out in the field and lit them on fire, and they go pop, 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 and these Muslim soldiers were like, hey, there's a fight going on. Let's jump in. And they left the castle to go fight, and they were able to rush reinforcements and supplies back into the castle. I mean, there's all these stories of John Smith being very creative. One battle, he the Muslims outnumber them, and so they have these long lances, and he takes them to put bales of hay on the front of their lances, lights them on fire, and then all his men like charge at the Muslims, you know. But they lose one battle, and he's left for dead on the field, and they see he's got armor on, so rather than killing him, they feel like he must be somebody important, so let's sell him as a slave. And so the Muslims had slavery. They enslaved 180 million Africans, and then they enslaved over 1 million Europeans, and there were entire Catholic orders in Europe. The head of the order was called the Ransomer, and they would go under a white flag to North Africa to get your friend back. And but this is when Captain John Smith was a slave in Constantinople. And one day, his master was beating him, and nobody else was around, so he rises up, kills the master, buries the guy in the straw, dresses himself in the guy's clothes, and rides off on the guy's horse to Russia. And he gets there, they take the iron ring off his neck, then he goes back, fights the Muslims more in Poland and Hungary, then he goes and fights the Muslims on the Mediterranean Sea, and he makes his way back to England in 1605. And in 1606, he sets sail to found the first English settlement in the New World. They try a couple spots, but then they finally settle on Jamestown in 1607. And if you've ever been to Jamestown, there's a statue of Captain John Smith right on the river, and it says he fought in Turkey and in Russia before settling Jamestown. Now, it doesn't tell you who he fought in Turkey, but it was the Muslims. Anyway, so here he is in the New World. Now, it's sort of interesting, Virginia. There's three types of colonies. There's company colonies, royal colonies, and proprietary colonies. Company colonies, there is a Virginia company with investors and bylaws, and they want a profit. There's 16 pages of investors in the Virginia company. What happened was is they didn't make a profit, and they were sort of mismanaged, and 3,000 of them died the first 10 years. Now, they thought they were going to be like another Port Royal. Well, you say, what do you mean, Port Royal? Well, Spain had the gold, and they were the Spanish ships were being attacked by the British and the French and the Dutch. The British didn't have a navy, so Queen Elizabeth had sort of subcontracted pirates. They were called privateers. She would give them a letter of marque and saying, look, you attack the Spanish ships and get their gold, I get half. But since you're a private person, when the Spaniards come to me, I can say, I don't know what you're doing. And so she can not have them declare war on her because you're just a rogue person. And so that was called a privateer. Now, you know the difference between a privateer and a pirate? Pirates are privateers gone haywire. Pirates will attack anybody. They'll attack their English, and they'll attack anybody. And then a buccaneer is a pirate gone on land. Baca means cow, and so they would, you know, the Spaniards would put cows on these islands, and every now and then, you know, so they have food. Somebody would say, hey, we're hungry on our ship. Let's just go over there and be a horse thief, you know, a cow thief, and they would steal the cow. And so they were called bacaneers or cow stealers. It was Captain Henry Morgan, the guy that the rum's named after. He noticed his letter of marque with the queen meant that he was supposed to give half of what he captured at sea. And he says, doesn't say anything about land. So he lands at Panama, goes behind and captures a Spanish fort and rapes and pillages and takes a whole lot of stuff, and he doesn't have to give any of it to the monarchs. Well, Spain says, look, the ruse is up. Spain, you know, England, we know you're behind this. You better stop this piracy or we're going to attack you. And so that's when they begin to send their British people into the Caribbean and saying, okay, we got to catch these pirates. And so but before that happened, are you still with me? Before that happened, the British ships are attacking the Spanish ships, and they decide they needed a place to unload their gold that's nearby. So Admiral William Penn, the father of William Penn, Admiral William Penn goes down to Jamaica and captures it from the Spanish. Kingston, Jamaica, at Dunn's Falls is where they have the battle. And so he starts this fort. It's called Port Royal. But it's too far away from England for the English Navy to defend. And so the people at Port Royal turn to the privateers and pirates and buccaneers for protection against the Spanish. And so that's when Port Royal becomes the pirate haven. And so if you remember the movie Pirates of the Caribbean, and they're going to this one island where they're drinking and chasing women, and it's this part, that was Port Royal. It was the richest colony that the British had in the New World until 1692. An earthquake struck, and the whole thing just slid underwater with this huge tsunami. And there was an Anglican minister there who says it was the judgment of God. Bodies were floating around, you know, God will destroy this whole sinful place, you know, because it was pretty sinful. I won't get into the stories. But anyway, so there were a bunch of people that were settling Jamestown that they thought it was just going to be another Port Royal, another place to unload some gold, and you're going to be there and get really wealthy. They didn't really think that they were starting another country. And so the founders of Virginia had a different motivation than the pilgrims who founded Massachusetts. And then, so Virginia originally was a company colony, and after 10 years, 3,000 of them die from starvation, disease, malaria, Indian attacks, and then they're bankrupt. And so they basically turn to the king, and they say, King, it's all yours. And it becomes a royal colony. Well, the king doesn't want to be bothered with colonial government, so he sends over a governor, a royal governor, and says, you have to raise your own taxes. You have to raise your own money to support yourself. The royal governor comes over and he says, okay, landowners, get together. I don't know how you're going to do it, but figure out amongst yourselves how I'm going to get my money. So these landowners get together and they form the Virginia House of Burgesses, the first legislative assembly in the New World. And so they backdoored themselves into legislative government just to raise taxes for this royal governor. So people say, isn't it terrible at the beginning of the country, only white landowners could vote? It's like, well, you got to look at it. It was the royal governor that wanted the taxes. They're the only ones that had the land and the money, and they were forced to get together to try to raise the money for him. It wasn't like, oh, we're all going to be equal. Anyway, so here's Virginia. Virginia was such a chaos that they finally decided to abandon it. And what's left of them gets on a boat, and they're sailing away. One person was about to torch the place but decided not to. They're sailing out of the harbor. When into the harbor comes a ship full of new recruits from England, captained by Captain Delaware. And they named the Delaware River after the guy. Anyway, so this Captain Delaware says, nope, you're not going back to England. We'll go back, and we'll try one last time. And so that was Jamestown. So it was providential that the pilgrims didn't land there, because had they landed there, they probably would have died in all the plagues and so forth. So now we're back to England and back to the pilgrims. So in England, the king doesn't think he needs any purifying. So he is persecuting the Puritans. And then there's another group that said, it's beyond hope of purifying. We're going to separate ourselves. And they're the separatists. And they would meet in barns and basements by candlelight. And William Brewster was the rich guy who had the big house. And they would all meet there in his country manor. But spies would come and peek in the window. Then the police would come and arrest them. And they'd stick them in the stocks. They'd stick them in jail. And they'd whip them. And a bunch of these pilgrim separatists decided to sell their property, and they believed in separation of church and state. They didn't think that the state should control their church. They wanted to have church the New Testament way. They didn't want a king-appointed pastor to tell them how to have church. And so they would sell their land, some of them, and then they went down to buy a ticket to Holland. Holland had a little bit more freedom, but a little bit looser morals. Sort of like the internet, you know? I mean, you got the blessing on one side, but you have the evil on the other side. And that's sort of the way Holland was. But they thought, well, we're going to take a shot at it because we're not having any freedom here in England. So they sell their farms, they buy tickets, they're on the boat, they're about ready to leave. When the captain finds out who they are, robs them all, turns them into the police, they get thrown in jail. Then another group of these pilgrim separatists sell their property, and they arrange for a Dutch ship to pick them up on the coast of England. And so the men row out with their boats, and they're stacking everything on the boats, and somebody snitches, and the British come over the hill and capture the women and children who were waiting on the shore. And the Dutch captain says, I'm not here to fight a war. We're out of here. He pulls anchor and sails back to Holland. And you can just imagine the women and children saying, husband, get back here. For 2 years, they pass those women and children from one court in England to another. Finally, they say, go home. You didn't do anything wrong. They go, duh, we sold our homes. And so out of frustration, they put them on a ship, send them over to Holland, and they finally find their husbands and they're reunited. So there was a happy ending to that chapter. Well, these pilgrims, by the way, the same year the pilgrims left England to go to Holland is the same year that John Smith and the Englishmen settled Jamestown. So for 12 years, Jamestown is going on with all these people dying. And for those same 12 years, the pilgrims are in Holland working three jobs a day, trying to learn another language, scraping by. It's so tough that no more pilgrims are joining them. And Spain's threatening to attack Holland. And so some of the young men want to join the Dutch military. And, you know, they have a little bit of looser morals. And so these pilgrim separatists in Holland say, you know what, we're going to be a one-generation movement. Our little church is just going to be swallowed up into the Dutch, and we'll be be forgotten by history. So they decide to go to the New World. They originally were going to go to Guyana in South America because it had a perpetual spring and everything grew. But then somebody says, well, they got diseases and it's too close to the Spanish Main. And again, they heard about the 1565 French Huguenot Protestant settlement in Fort Caroline, Florida. And that's when they got butchered. And so they said, no, we don't want to go anywhere near Spain. So they said, well, you know, by the same time we came to Holland, this group went over to Jamestown. Maybe let's join them. So they contact the king through a bunch of, you know, royal court people. And they say, can we go over there and practice our religion? And he says, no, I'm not going to recognize any other religion other than the Anglican one. But they get some advisors and they sort of talk to the king, catch him on a good day. And he sort of says, well, if they go over there and they don't make a fuss, I'll just sort of pretend like I don't see them and they can sort of do their stuff. So the pilgrims say, great. So they go to England, they borrow money, and they get a ship called the Speedwell, but it doesn't speed well. It starts leaking, so they have to go back, and they swap it out for the Mayflower. Meanwhile, they're eating through their supplies, and the summer months are turning into fall and winter months. And then finally, they set sail, and they're coming across the North Atlantic. So anyway, that's the Puritans. And here they are in Holland, and the pilgrims are there for 12 years, and there's the Dutch windmills. So they set sail in the Mayflower, and they come across. This is the boat, and because they're now sailing in the wintertime, it's freezing cold, so they're confined to the between deck. 4-foot-high space for like 3 months, and no bathrooms, you know, just the pot, you know, and the privacy. They would hang sheets down, you know, and the boat's tossing to and fro for months. You know, and they're singing psalms. There was this one sailor that was just mocking them and making fun of them and says how he couldn't wait to throw them all to the fishes in the ocean and watch them die. And all this guy's like such an obnoxious person. The other sailors are even feeling bad. All of a sudden, the sailor dies suddenly. And the other sailors are like, we don't want to say anything bad about these pilgrims. And anyway, one young pilgrim is so wanting fresh air because of the stench, he goes topside just as a freezing wave sweeps the deck, knocks him into the ocean. And he starts sinking, but the ship was tipping over because of the storm, and a rope is dragging in the water. And he catches the rope, and he's like 3 fathoms down, which would be like 18 feet. And then finally the ship comes back and pulls him up. They get this big iron hook, and they somehow grab him, and they pull him in, and he's like blue. He survives. His name's John Howland. And his descendants include everybody from Franklin Roosevelt to Humphrey Bogart to George Bush. They can trace their way back. You know those people that trace genealogies. Anyway, the storm is bad so that one of the beams crack that's holding up the main mast. And some of the sailors said, oh, we got to turn back, go back to England. But someone had an iron screw, like when you're like jacking up the foundation of a house with a beam, you know, and they put that under the screw. So they stick it under this thing and they crack it back in place. And they finally make it over to the New World. And they land at the wrong spot. Instead of Virginia, they're landing at Cape Cod at Plymouth Rock. Now, they try to go out around there, but right when they're getting around here, it's what's called Tucker's Terror. It's the graveyard of ships. Right under the water, there's a whole bunch of rocks. And as they're going through there, the wind stalls. There's no wind. And all of a sudden, the waves are like pushing them closer to these rocks, and they're about to get smashed. And so the captain barely makes it out of there and says, look, guys, you're going to spend the winter here. And so they're like, there's no government to submit to. We can't just have every man get off the boat and be a law unto themselves. We got to have some kind of law. And so they decide to write the what? The Mayflower Compact. It's the first constitution written in the New World. And they get together, and it says, in the name of God, amen, we the hereby undersigned, having undertaken for the glory of God and the advancement of the Christian faith, a voyage to plant the first colony on the northern parts of Virginia. And then a little line in there that says, in ye presence of God, we mutually covenant ourselves together to form a civil body politic and agree to render all due submission to the laws that we pass. Now, that little phrase, as simple as it sounded, was revolutionary. As I mentioned, I read through most of the charters. I read through all the charters of all the colonies, and most of them, the king is appointing who's in charge, who's going to be his royal governor, who's going to make the decisions. It's all decided ahead of time. This was not the king. This was them granting themselves permission for a government under God and then agreeing to obey the laws that they corporately pass. That was revolutionary. When the Puritans came over later, 9 years later, and settled Massachusetts, the Puritans are like, how are you doing your government without a king to hold your hand every day? And they go, well, we do this whole thing. We submit to each other under God, and we agree to all these laws. And then that became a blueprint for Connecticut, and Connecticut kept its constitution up until 1818, so Connecticut's called the Constitution State. But Connecticut's constitution, you go through their license plate, says the Constitution State. And then Connecticut's constitution became a blueprint for the U.S. Constitution, which starts off how? We, the people of the United States, we're granting ourselves permission for a government. It's not like Canada or Australia where they still, you know, acknowledge the monarch of England in their commonwealth. No, we're it. And the word federal is Latin for covenant. So we actually have a covenant form of government. And now where did these pilgrims learn how to do this covenant form of government? From their New Testament pastor, John Robinson, over in Holland, from the Bible. So for those people that say, oh, well, we don't want the church to influence government, it's like, duh, our government was founded because it was adapting the church government. And there's four different kinds of church government, right? There's the hierarchical, which is the king appointed or from the top down. There's the presbyters, the elders, and that sort of helped our country where we got the elected representatives. And then there's the congregational, which is where the democracy, people voting, and then there's the independent. So you see these pilgrims land there, and they get off with the Mayflower Compact. They're wandering around from November 11th, and they do a little exploring. And they finally, around December, begin to start building their first building. And the men get off, and they're chopping wood. It's cold. They're sweating. They're catching colds. They're catching fevers. They're dying of pneumonia. One dies, two, three, four, a dozen, two dozen, three dozen, four dozen. At one point, there's only like six people healthy enough to take care of the rest and do all the queasy things, that's what the word used, you know, that people with squeamish stomachs don't like to be, you know, talk about. They bury him at nighttime so nobody will know, and the next spring in March, half of them are dead. And they probably would not have made it through another year. Anyway, here's some picture of them, you know, going ashore and how cold it is, and they get off in wintertime on this coast, and there's some pictures there of the pilgrims. So here's the landing of the pilgrims in wintertime. How would you like to do that? I mean, there's no Motel 6s. You know, they'll run down to the store quick, get something. No, they can't. There's Miles Standish. He was their captain. And then in March of 1621, out of the woods walks Squanto. And lo and behold, Squanto talked to them in perfect English. He's like, oh, London, yeah, I used to live there. I mean, it's like, yeah, I used to go to high school there. But it's like, what? Where did you... And Squanto, lo and behold, the British used to fish up and down the English colonies, even though they were afraid to start a colony because of the Spanish. And so every now and then, unscrupulous fishermen would lure some of these Indians on the boat, take them to Spain, sell them to slavery for a quick buck. And so that's what happened to Squanto. He was taken as a slave, sold in Spain. Tradition has it, he was purchased by some monks, given his freedom. He hitchhikes his way to England, works in London for years, makes his way back to Newfoundland, finds a boat to drop him off in Massachusetts at Cape Cod, only to find his entire family's dead. Imagine how depressed you would be your whole life. I just want to get back home. I want to get back home. You get there, and they're all dead. So he must have been really disillusioned. You know. Now, ironically enough, had he not been kidnapped, he probably would have died in a plague. What happened was there was a plague that wiped out that whole tribe. What happened? William Bradford says that 3 years before they landed, a French fishing boat was shipwrecked right at Cape Cod. The Indians got the sailors got ashore, but the Indians never left watching them and dogging them till they got the advantage, killed them all but three or four, whom they sent from one sachem to another, making sport of them, using them worse than slaves. You know, Indians had an on-off switch. When they're peaceful, they're peaceful. When they're violent, they were violent. You know, there's stories of these Catholic missionaries that came down from France, and the Indians would capture them and tie them up to a pole and gnaw the meat off their fingers while they're watching. And then so this one missionary, they'd have him crawling around with his stubs, you know, and trying to gather meat in the wintertime. And he finally escapes to some French fort and makes his way back to Europe. And, the Pope would kiss his gnarled fingers. And after a while, he goes back to America as a missionary, and then he gets killed. So there's a lot of horror stories of the savages, you know. I mean, when they're peaceful, but when they're not, you know. And so the pilgrims land at the one spot where there's no Indians. Why? Because these French got ashore, and the Indians never left watching them and dogging them. And then they all died, but one of them, at least one of them, must have had some illness that the Indians caught, and it wiped out that whole tribe because they did not have immunity to these European diseases. And so the pilgrims land there, and there's no Indians. But the next spring, March of 1621, half their group dies, and out of the woods comes Squanto. And he talks to them in perfect English. I mean, you just imagine how the dismay they must have had. You know, I mean, here's this guy says, oh, how you guys doing? You know, oh, you were in London? Yeah, yeah, I know, down on the Wharf Street, you know. And anyway, he is their interpreter with the other Indian tribes and puts them on good terms so they don't have the Indian attacks like Jamestown had. And here's what William Bradford writes. Squanto stayed with them and was their interpreter and a special instrument sent of God for their good beyond their expectation. He showed them how to plant corn, where to take fish and other commodities, and guided them to unknown places. He never left them until he died. He said, well, we got to, you know, get rid of fish. They said, we tried fishing. He says, no, there's this fish called a salmon, and it spawns, and this river's going to be packed. You're going to be harvesting it. And then he says, well, you're not planting corn. He goes, we don't know how to. He says, well, you put the corn down, you put a dead fish over it, wait a couple of weeks, and fertilizes the soil, and you have a nice corn stalk. And then he's talking about how to take the corn, put it in a pot, shake it over a fire, and make popcorn. And then they had to pay back their investors the money they borrowed for their boat ride. And Squanto teaches them how to catch beaver. And it was 40 years worth of beaver skins to pay off their boat ride. Now, Virginia, they paid off their debt with tobacco, right? That was their crop. Anyway, so here's the Indians. There's Squanto. And so the first Thanksgiving is in October, November of 1621. And Squanto's able to get the Indians to come and bring the turkey and the deer. And Ben Franklin wanted the turkey to be the national bird for America. He says, it's a good bird. It's native here. You can eat it. It's a source of all the, you know, nutrition. He says the eagle is just a scavenger. You know, anyway. But and then the pilgrims had their bread and their puddings. And at the end of the first Thanksgiving, the pilgrims see the Indians just wrap up in their blankets on the ground. And then the next morning, they're still there. They get up. They have Thanksgiving a second day. And then at the end of that, the Indians wrap up in their blankets on the ground. They wake up, and the first Thanksgiving went on for 3 days. And you know, the boys leg wrestle and arm wrestle and so forth. And anyway, this is one of the stories. William Bradford says that the adventurers, which were the investors, sent over two fishing ships. The pinnace was ordered to load with corfish and to bring home to England. And besides, she had some 800 pounds of beaver as well as other food. So here's the pilgrims. They load up a ship with 800 pounds of beaver skins to bring back to England to trade. And so William Bradford says they went joyfully home together and had such fine weather that he never cast off the smaller ship till they were well within the English Channel, almost inside of Plymouth, England. But even there, she was unhappily taken by a Turkish man of war, carried off to Salem, Morocco, where the captain and the crew were made slaves. Thus, all their hopes were dashed, and the joyful news they meant to carry home was turned into heavy tidings. The friendly adventurers, investors, were so reduced by their losses last year, and now by the ship taken by the Turks, that all trade was dead. So 5 years after the pilgrims had their little landing, the Muslims captured one of their ships. So they had experience with the Muslim Brotherhood and Sharia law and so forth. And now I thought this is interesting. The pilgrims, when they came over, they were part of the Virginia Company. Again, it's a company colony, and the company has bylaws. And these bylaws said, this is what it said, 1620, July 1st. One, the adventurers and planters do agree that every person that goeth, being aged 16 years and upward, be accounted a single share of, you know, stock in the Virginia Company there. The persons transported and the adventurer shall continue their joint stock partnership together, be space of 7 years, during which time all profits and benefits that are got by trade, traffic, trucking, working, fishing, or any other means of any persons remain still in ye common stock until ye division. And at the end of ye 7 years, ye capital and profits, visa the houses, lands, goods, chattel, be equally divided betwixt ye adventurers and planters, and all such persons as are of this colony are to have their meat, drink, apparel, and provision out of ye common stock of goods. This was communism. And William Bradford says that nobody wanted to go out and plant corn. Nobody wanted to work. Why? Because, you know, it was, well, matter of fact, this is what he says. The failure of that experiment of communal service, which was tried for several years, and by good and honest men, proves that the emptiness of the theory of Plato, Plato's the one who came up with communism, everybody owns everything in common, and of other ancients applauded by some latter times, that the taking away of private property and the possession of it in community by a commonwealth would make a state happy and flourishing as if they were wiser than God. He says, For in this instance, community of property, so far as it went, was found to breed much confusion and discontent and retard much employment, which would have been to the general benefit and comfort. For the young men who were most able and fit for service objected to being forced to spend their time and strength in working for other men's wives and children without any recompense. The strong man or the resourceful man had no more share of food and clothes, etc., than the weak man who was not able to do a quarter of his work. This was thought injustice. The aged and graver men who were ranked and equalized in labor, food, and clothes with the humbler and younger ones thought it some indignity and disrespect to them. As for the men's wives, who were obliged to do service for other men, such as cooking, washing their clothes, etc., they considered it a kind of slavery, and many husbands would not brook it or allow it. If it were thought that all were to share alike and all were to do alike, then all were to on an equality throughout, and one was as good as another. And so if it did not actually abolish those very relations which God himself had set amongst men, it did at least greatly diminish the mutual respect that is so important should be preserved amongst them. Let none argue that this is due to human failing, rather than to this communistic plan of life in itself. I answer, seeing that all men have this failing in them, that God in his wisdom saw that another plan of life was fitter for them. He goes on to say, so they began to consider how to raise more corn and how to obtain a better crop than they had done, so that they might not continue to endure the misery of want. At length, after much debate, the governor, with the advice of the chief among them, allowed each man to plant corn for his own household, and to trust themselves for that in all other things to go in the general ways before. So every family was assigned a parcel of land according to the proportion of their number. This was very successful. It made all hands very industrious, so that much more corn was planted than otherwise would have been by any other means the governor or any other could devise, and saved him a great deal of trouble and gave far better satisfaction. The women now went willingly into the field and took their little ones with them to plant corn, while before they would allege weakness and inability, and to have compelled them would have been thought great tyranny and oppression. So the pilgrims tried this communism, this Occupy Wall Street, everybody owns everything in common, redistribute the wealth. It didn't work. And they said, look, every family gets their own plot, and what you plant grows. Anyway, what happened to Squanto? Squanto was with them for several years. And then William Bradford says one day they were exploring around Cape Cod, and they were in the water in a boat, and a freezing rain comes, and it says they could not get around the shoals of Cape Cod for the flats and breakers, the wavy water. So they put in at Manamoyac Bay. Here, Squanto fell ill of Indian fever, bleeding much at the nose, which the Indians take for a symptom of death. And within a few days, he died. He begged the governor to pray for him, that he might go to the Englishman's God in heaven, and bequeath several of his things to his English friends in remembrance that his death was a great loss. Now, what does it mean? He begged Governor Bradford to pray for him that he might go to the Englishman's God in heaven. These pilgrims were real serious Christians. They came to America for the freedom to have their New Testament church. They were not motivated by the gold or the, you know, necessarily what was going on in Virginia. They literally wanted to found a new country, a new way to live, and they based it on the Bible. And so they were living their Christian life in front of Squanto. And after he saw it, he basically said, I want your God. Right? Sort of like Rahab that, told her mom, you know, your God will be my God, and so forth. And so this is our Thanksgiving. And so when we celebrate this Thanksgiving, we can remember the those that began this great country. And we do have a really unique country. It does have a Christian foundation to it that we celebrate. And I know I've shared this thought before, but it's worth sharing again for those that haven't heard it. But someday you're going to be dead. So I'd let you think about that for a minute. But you're going to be in heaven because you believe that Jesus died for your sins, so you don't have to. I love the explanation of the gospel as the law and the lamb. You read through the Old Testament, the Pentateuch, the first five books, and you got all these laws, dietary laws, civil laws, religious laws, and they break them all the time, and God knew they were going to break them, so he already had sacrifices set up to patch up things with their relationship with God, right? And so you sacrifice the oxen and goats. And so wherever blood is sacrificed in the Old Testament, it's foreshadowing Jesus' sacrifice, right? So you got the law to show you're a sinner, and then the lamb to pay for your sin. I had somebody explain it as the bathroom mirror and then the soap and the water. The mirror shows you how dirty your face is, but it has no power to cleanse your face. But it serves a purpose. It shows you your need for the soap and the water. Right? You can go into the mirror and look at it all day long, but if there was no mirror, you wouldn't know that you're dirty, right? You can't see your own face. You'd think, I'm as good as anybody else. I'm certainly not as dirty as that guy. Look at him. I'm an okay guy. You know, I'm okay with God. I'm all right. You think you're all right? Try to keep this for a little while. Pfft, the perfect law of God. All right, I can do this. Whoa. Don't lie. Don't cheat. Don't steal. Whoa. And see, the thing is with the law, in James, it says if you offend in one point of the law, it's as if you broke the whole law. All right, the policeman can pull you over and say, you speak, but officer, I didn't murder anybody. I didn't rape. I didn't kill it. Yeah, but you broke one part of it. And now you're going to get in trouble. And so that if you want to go to heaven by being good enough, it's one strike and you're out. Right? And so here's the perfect law of God. You go, whoa, if this is what it takes to get to heaven, I'll never make it. I need help. Now I got your attention. Here's the help, the blood of Jesus to cleanse you of your sin. Right? So you wouldn't appreciate Jesus unless you had God's perfect law. You know, that's one of the problems with evangelism. Sometimes we don't have God's law. People say, I'm not a real sinner. You know, I'm an okay person. But the law shows you your need for the lamb. The mirror shows you your need for the soap and the water. Anyway, you believe in the soap and the water, the blood of Jesus. It cleanses us of our sin, thank God. And because of that, you're going to be in heaven. And when we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun, with no less days to sing his praise than one you've just begun. Imagine you've been in heaven 10,000 years, and you get a chance to meet Moses. You know, you're walking down the streets of gold, and you bump into him. Maybe Moses will invite you over to his place. You know, Jesus said, in my Father's house there are many mansions. I don't know what type of place he's got, but I bet it's going to be pretty nice. I bet Moses will have one of these big fireplaces where the logs don't burn out. You know, the burning bush in the wilderness didn't burn up, and the logs in the fireplace. I heard one scholar say that in heaven you'll be able to travel as fast as you think, and I'll probably show up late. My wife will say, where were you? I was thinking about something else. But imagine we're all showing up at Moses' place, maybe like today. Maybe he's got a big living room, and we're all there, and all the small talk's over. Finally, you can't contain yourself. You reach over, and maybe he's sitting right in front of you. You reach over, and you tap him on the shoulder, and you say, Moses, what was it like? I mean, I read the book, I saw the movie, but here you are in person. And Moses will stand up and he'll say, well, you know, I was 80 years old. And Pharaoh, the most powerful military leader in the world, was charging in at us, going 30 miles an hour with these razor-sharp swords, going to slice us to ribbon. And I just stood there with my staff and I said, God, use me to deliver your people. And the waves came in and swallowed up Pharaoh and his chariots. We're going to say, wow. Then we're going to look around the room and see David and say, David, tell us your story. He's going to stand up and say, well, you know, I was just 17, and this thug, Goliath, was mocking our God and making fun of our religion, and all these grown-ups were too chicken to do anything about it. And I said, well, enough of them, I'm going to do something. And I didn't know everything they knew, but I knew how to use my little sling, and I went and hit him in the head and took his own sword and chopped his head off. We're going to say, wow. Then one by one, we're going to go around the room, and, you know, Gideon's going to tell his story, and, you know, Deborah and Apostle Paul, and one by, and then finally, everybody's going to look at you. Say, you, we haven't heard from you yet. What did you do when it was your turn to be on earth? What were they saying about God in your country? You know, about the baby that the Lord knew in the mother's womb, or the Ten Commandments that God gave to Moses, or marriage that God instituted in Genesis, or what did you do by that lonely person down the street? Or what did you do when Pastor had a vision to reach out? You know, or these Christmas baskets, you know? And you know, I'd hate for any of us to be in heaven and to be squirming in our seat saying, can you call on somebody else for a minute? Let me think about this. Or maybe to have a screen come down and Jesus to show all kinds of great things and people coming to the Lord and him saying, you know, this is what you could have done if you'd have been just a little more sold out to me when you were on earth. And to realize you can't go back down and do anything for him. But guess what? We're still on this earth. We still have breath in our lungs. We still have feet to trod the soil. We still can do those things that we will be known for forever. So yes, there's crisis, but there's always been crisis, but God is with you. Greater is he that's in you than he that's in the world. He'll not allow you to be tempted above what you're able. He's going to be with you all the way. This is our time. He chose out of all the 6,000 years of history for you to be alive right now. So roll up your sleeves. He's slapping you on the back saying, get in the game. This is your turn to do those great things that you'll be known for forever. God bless you. Thank you, Pastor, so much for the privilege of being here. God bless you and happy Thanksgiving.